In Tokyo, my name is Fernando Groh.
In Hong Kong, my name is James Marsh, and this is the Society for Film. On today's show, we're going to be discussing Thor, The Dark World. We'll also be hearing a little bit from Fernando about the Toho 10am Festival, a collection of classic films screening on the big screen. In particular, this week, he saw The Day of the Jackal. And then we'll also be talking about The Hunger Games Catching Fire. So how are you doing, Fernando?
Not too bad. Enjoying the cooling weather of Tokyo at the moment. We're well into autumn now. The leaves have turned gold and orange, and the nights are drawing in, which is a good opportunity to try and catch up on lots of films. I have my own personal goal for how many films I want to see before the end of the year, which is probably about the same as the number of films you see every month.
Well, dare I ask, what is the number?
Oh, I like to. There was a time once when I was able to see well over 300 films a year.
Right.
But these days,
is this across all formats?
Across all formats, but these days my modest total is to be well over 150. That's the way I put it.
Okay.
And I've been able to keep that pace for a couple of years now, and it looks like I'll be able to do that again this year. But as I've mentioned, it's getting harder. I mean, it's not just getting harder because I'm old and decrepit and I have a child. It's also getting harder because television is getting better and better all the time. So one is swayed by the good new television programs and away from watching films. But
Wait, you're not talking about like Tokyo broadcasting, are you? I mean,
not quite.
Your Japanese isn't that good, is it?
No, my Japanese isn't that good. And actually, I've lived without cable TV for goodness, 4 or 5 years now. So it is the good old watching high quality series on DVD or streamed across the internet.
Right. Is there anything in particular that you've been watching at the moment?
Newsroom has definitely caught my attention lately. Breaking Bad was one of the ones that I, you know, as I think most of the rest of the Western world, enjoyed watching.
Absolutely.
The end of that. Just some of the usual suspects.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, good, because that's hopefully going to make up for the fact that you have you haven't actually seen the first film that we're going to talk about this evening, have you?
No.
Which is Alan Taylor's Thor, The Dark World, the latest entry in the Marvel catalogue.
No, I haven't managed to see it. And unfortunately, that is completely outside of my control because the film does not open here in Tokyo until Valentine's Day weekend 2014.
That's crazy. I mean, the Blu-ray is probably going to be out by then.
Exactly. I completely expect that I will have seen the 3D Blu-ray at home. Possibly even long before it actually opens on the cinema here, which has been the way with a few of the major blockbusters lately. That was the case. The latest Star Trek film only opened a few weeks ago here in Tokyo.
Right.
So it's been a little bit of a rhythm for the last few years here that we get these big blockbusters pretty much at the end of their cinematic cycle.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit all over the place, though, isn't it, really? I mean, but it must be a bit of a shock to your system because Singapore, conversely, was quite good, wasn't it?
Yeah, and in fact, for a few of these films, Singapore was one of the opening screenings worldwide.
Yeah, you were regularly seeing stuff before I was.
Yeah.
Like weeks ahead.
Exactly, and often seeing things up to a week and maybe a few days before it opened in the US. So it's very bizarre, and generally across Asia, we're getting films opening quite early these days. Films are opening in Australia fairly early. Hong Kong, you're often getting them the same weekend or the same week as they open in the US, or maybe a week or two later.
Yeah, I mean, it's all around within a week or two. I think there's still a couple of the big ones, like the Avengers, we're getting a week before.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, Disney and a couple of the other companies, particularly Disney, actually, they're experimenting with different ideas of opening overseas and then opening in the States, which is upsetting a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's quite nice for everybody else. But I think, you know, it's all... Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, we've spent our entire lives waiting for your films. So
Now that they're made out here.
Exactly. I mean, I understand it with some films, but with the big summer blockbusters, particularly with what Disney and Marvel are doing, they're releasing so many films a year. You know, there's two or three a year that they're releasing in a very specific orchestrated schedule in order to build towards the next Avengers movie or the next whatever. Because you say you're not getting Thor the Dark World until February. Well, Captain America, the Winter Soldier, the second Captain America film, is scheduled for like March, I think, to come out in the States.
Exactly.
So that's going to really mess with all of that.
And also, these are not films that are commercial risks. I mean, okay, they may or may not meet expectation, but generally these films are doing pretty well.
Oh, I think Thor the Dark World in particular has exceeded expectations. I mean, I know it was always the one member of the Avengers that they were a bit more nervous about, and they were a bit less sure of, you know, how marketable he was going to be to people outside of the comic book fan world.
It's a little bit more high concept a story, and
it's a tougher sell for sure.
Yeah,
but then the first film proved, you know, pretty good, and then he was, you know, he established the character and really sort of developed it more in the Avengers, and I think here as well in the Dark World, it proves a pretty successful venture all in all, and I think he has that crossover appeal that they hadn't quite anticipated, and you might say the studios never fully anticipate, which is the fact that girls like him as well, because he's a bit of a hottie.
Exactly, which always helps. And I think that's one of the issues, you know, when you look at smaller films, sometimes they open much later in this part of the world or outside of their home markets because they're a little bit more of a commercial risk.
Right, I mean, if at all.
Yeah, exactly. But these are all very, very, very bankable films. The other thing I was going to say that's interesting is that even India is opening some of these films earlier than we are getting them here in Japan.
Wow.
And quite a way earlier. So,
That's funny because I was going to say, I was going to suggest that perhaps one of the reasons they were being delayed or pushed out of the summer in Japan is because they have to compete with the Japanese homegrown product in a way that, you know, that's not a problem in other countries. Even over here, it's not really an issue.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you're saying it's happening in India, I guess that kind of negates that argument somewhat, because obviously the Indian film industry is thriving as ever over there.
Exactly, and they are directly competing. You know, in India, yeah. They're directly competing with locally made quite high quality action films. So although there isn't, to my knowledge, a Bollywood Thor yet,
no,
there are definitely, you know, films that are in that general, I guess, genre world, or action thriller world that these films are competing directly against.
I mean, there's certainly been an upsurge in popularity of domestic product in Japan.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that has got something to do with it.
But I mean, I do wonder because I don't know whether it's a rationing out of the number of major international blockbusters that are on at any one time. It would be interesting. We need to track this down and get an answer, I think, James.
I think you should approach the PR companies and the distributors directly and ask them what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
You know. What are they playing at? Because, you know, it goes against everything that the studios are trying to do in order to combat piracy and what have you. It's had these blanket day and date openings everywhere. You know, it's arguably it's one of the reasons why everything went digital or is continuing to go digital, is so that, you know, at the end of the day, possibly not too many years in the future, somebody at Disney HQ will just be able to press play and the film will open globally at the same time. Just from the touch of a button.
Well, I imagine that's more or less possible now, really, if they...
You still have to send over the DCP tapes. You know, they're not remotely connected yet to some sort of single server in Hollywood. But it's not too many years away. You can get stuff beamed by satellite across. And that'll be a hell of an event when it happens.
Yeah, and it is basically now an open invitation to piracy here in Japan. That's my own personal feeling about it.
Is piracy a big, without going off on a huge tangent, is piracy a big problem over there?
I get the impression that it is a a bit of a problem. But to be fair, you know, Japan is quite well known as a market where people pay for CDs and DVDs. So actual physical DVD rental is still quite a big deal here in Japan.
Right.
And physical DVD and CD, so, I mean, Japan's probably one of the few major markets in the world where music CDs still sell well.
That's great news.
So it's a mixed bag. I get the impression that piracy is definitely an issue, and certainly we get some very entertaining anti-piracy ads that screen before the features here in Japan. But I'm not sure it's been as big an issue here as it has, say, in the US or Australia or the UK or Hong Kong, for that matter.
Right, right. Yeah, here where it's pretty rife and everybody will just go to China and buy whatever they want.
Exactly.
Immediately. Okay.
Exactly.
So, well, that's fascinating. I mean, it's obviously going to be, it's going to take some coordinating to see what's going to come to you and what isn't, and what we're going to be able to sort of discuss.
Exactly. And I'll be relying on what screens on flights and trying to see movies every time I travel as well.
You're going to go on holiday just to watch films now, aren't you?
That could happen. It could happen. Put it this way,
like
I'm definitely checking what's on and what's likely to open when I go to Hong Kong next month, just in case I can sneak some things in.
I will plan you a full schedule of titles.
Sounds magnificent. Now, James, it sounds like Thor is doing battle with the forces of dark and evil outside of your place right now in Hong Kong.
Yeah, there is some serious hammer action going on. I apologise for that. They are putting the finishing touches to a huge apartment block that is about 10 feet away. It's literally across a side street from my house. And they have, you know, as ever, they pull out the jackhammers and the pneumatic drills every time we start a Skype call.
Exactly. And, I think they see the microphone being unsheathed. And
they do. They see the little light come on and they're like, go! Okay, and you know, so in that respect, I apologise, but there's very little I can actually do about it, and I refuse to be at their mercy. But in the meantime, from their hammers to a particular hammer, Minithir, or whatever it is. Sorry, hardcore Thor fans. Mirnir, I think it's called. Mirnir, the Muppet hammer.
Exactly. So the hammer comes out again.
The hammer does. It is wielded once more in the Dark World, which essentially sees Thor on Asgard struggling with the fact that his brother has just tried to destroy the world and do all that stuff he did in the Avengers, and comes home and his father, Odin, played again by Anthony Hopkins, is trying to pass on power to Thor, but Thor just sees himself more as a warrior. He's out there on the front lines doing battle against various adversaries and is reluctant to get involved in the politics or anything like that. Meanwhile, Loki has been locked up and put in the dungeons of Asgard. And really, though, Thor is pining for, what's her name, Jane Parker, is it? Jane Foster, sorry, Natalie Portman's character,
yes.
Who is back on Earth and is trying to, you know, monitor weather or whatever it is she does down there. With Kat Dennings, and she's having an equally miserable time.
Yes, because Thor had promised to return for her, and she didn't make an appearance in the Avengers film. We get a little side that she's just been shipped off to Sweden or Norway or Iceland or somewhere.
There's one line saying, "Oh, don't worry, she's safe."
Yes, exactly.
or she wasn't contractually obliged to be in this film, and so we're not paying her
exactly.
to be in it. And it's funny because they do make a note of that. When Thor does see her again for the first time, she's a little pissed. Because it's kind of like you would say to a boyfriend or whatever, girlfriend, you're like, you were in New York, I saw you on the news, why didn't you get in touch?
Exactly.
And he was like,
you're in town and you didn't say hello.
Right. And he's like, well, I was kind of busy, you know, saving the world and all the rest of it. So they do, you know, they do make light of the various sort of I don't know if you would call it a plot hole, but the
a narrative anomaly.
There you go. Beautifully, beautifully put.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, everything does not stay happy and well and peaceful for very long. And what's his name? Christopher Eccleston, almost unrecognizable as King of the Space Elves, turns up and...
You managed to say that without breaking into laughter afterwards.
I know.
King of the Space Elves.
Yes, his name is Malekith. He is King of the Space Elves, which was a dormant race that have now just woken up, and they're intent on using something gooey, this gooey black stuff called the Aether, to conquer Asgard and banish the nine realms, of which Earth is one, or the universe that we know of is one, and Asgard is another. Those nine realms to eternal darkness. But not before Jane and her cronies discover, essentially it's like a black hole in London. And when they investigate it, she falls through it, and it's actually a kind of portal through the nine different realms, and she finds herself essentially imprisoned in a realm that she knows not where.
Okay.
So that's essentially the setup for Thor, the Dark World. And it brings back all the familiar faces. You know, Loki really shouldn't probably be in this film, but of course they find a way to bring him back. He was so hugely popular in the first film and hugely popular in the Avengers that he is this kind of lovable rogue of a villain who they do a very good job of handling, because essentially, you know, he was the out-and-out villain of the Avengers, and yet he's such an important character. And he is Thor's brother and all the rest of it, and he's not all bad. They can't just kill him or forever banish him to, I don't know, whatever Asgard's equivalent of Arkham Asylum is. And so they have to kind of soften him up a bit, and or at least forgive him to a degree. And they write him back in, and he ends up buddying up with Thor in order to save the day, because he's the only person that has broken out of Asgard, and they need, you know, once Malekith comes in and attacks them, they need to break out and escape and get back to Earth and save Jane and save the Earth from the evil space elves and all this kind of nonsense.
So, I mean, that really is Tom Hiddleston's performance has really made that, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think anybody would foresaw Loki being so important. I wonder whether he was even originally supposed to be the villain in the Avengers until they thought, oh, this guy's good. And he really is, and he's great, you know, and he gets all the best lines again, and he does a good job.
He benefits from Joss Whedon's writing in The Avengers, there's no question about it. He gets some fantastic lines and insults and everything else, and he really...
he calls someone a sort of a quim or someone, doesn't he?
This mewling sort of, quim.
Yeah, this great sort of Chaucerian dialogue.
Exactly.
Which is great. And again, what I will say is that this film, again, kind of suffers from the fact that its lead characters, Thor and Jane Foster, aren't all that exciting, really. They're not quite as multifaceted as you might want from leading roles. And so they both kind of rely on their supporting characters, whether it's Loki or whether it's Kat Dennings, his sort of comedy sidekick for Jane, who I like. I warm to her as a screen presence. I think she's kind of cute and kind of funny, and she gets a lot of sort of good lines there about being, you know, just being sort of sassy and a bit...
I'd kind of push it the other way and say she's very cute and very, very funny. I mean, she's in a TV show called Two Broke Girls, which is a little bit formulaic for its own good. But her comic timing is excellent.
I'd go so far as to say she's the only thing that makes that show worth watching at all.
I think that's not. I don't think anybody really disputes that.
Yeah, and, I've caught it on a few flights, and it's like she's bunked up with essentially Paris Hilton or someone, isn't it?
An equivalent
of Paris Hilton, whose parents are broke and she's now broke, and she has to live in Brooklyn with this girl who's supposed to be awful, but is actually rather delightful thanks to Kat Dennings.
Exactly, and her performance in the first Thor film really grows on you. It's actually one of the performances that is even more enjoyable the second time you see the film.
Right, and which I haven't seen it more than once actually, so I have not allowed her to grow on me.
So when you do see it a second time, you may well agree with my opinion.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, but overall, the film is good. It's not great. It's not a classic. And, the Avengers, they made a very, very wise choice after the Avengers. With Iron Man 3 and then with Thor, and then they've got Captain America 2 coming out as well. They have reserved, or what am I trying to say? They
held
have
back.
Not. They have held back from simply trying to top the Avengers. You know, I think they understand, or they want to promote the idea and make us understand that the Avengers is something bigger. And therefore, the next film in the Marvel series will not be a sequel to the Avengers. Avengers 2, Age of Ultron, or whatever it's going to be called in 2015, that is a sequel to the Avengers. What you will have now are the further adventures of each Avenger. And they will pretty much do things separately.
Hmm.
You might occasionally have somebody else pop up. But in Thor particularly, he relies solely on Loki to be the other Avenger that pops up. Although there is one, I won't say who it is or where, how it happens, but one of the other Avengers does appear very briefly and is arguably the biggest laugh in the whole film. And it's, and it's great. It's spectacular, actually.
Good. And do we get our usual one or two post-credit moments as well?
There are two in this one.
Okay.
The first one is very much a building block for something to come. It's introducing a character we haven't seen before, and a character I had to look up afterwards, which is often the case for non-hardcore fans. But apparently this is building specifically, I believe, towards Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
I didn't do too much reading into it, but I read up who the character was, and it's played by a very recognisable actor, who I won't say who that is. But apparently the linkage is that he links more to Guardians of the Galaxy than anything else.
Okay,
which is
building even further ahead.
Exactly. And then there is a second... That happens sort of midway through the end credits, and then there is a second... credit sequence, a very, very, very sort of post-credit sequence right at the very end, which is just a kind of throwaway gag, really.
Okay.
It's clearly not meant to mean anything more than what it is. It's silly. It's cute, but it's a bit silly. And
okay.
It doesn't really mean anything.
And that's just a thank you to the fans for sitting through all the credits.
Yeah, it's just a joke. It's just a myth, you know, and a bit of punctuation. So overall, I mean, Thor the Dark World works in as much as it has a better balance, I think, between the stuff on Asgard and the stuff on Earth than it did first time out. I think under Kenneth Branagh's direction, the Asgardian stuff felt very Shakespearean, very grand, and I think that stuff sold really well, and I think that was the stuff they were most worried about. And then the final act and the big showdown on Earth with a big metal robot in the desert was a huge letdown. And essentially it was all about Thor getting his hammer back, and then there was this big confrontation and everybody just kind of shrugged and went, well, that was a ridiculous third act that just whimpered and went nowhere. What they've done this time is they get the balance much better. It's a different director this time. It's a guy called Alan Taylor, who I think he has done a film or two before, but he's best known certainly in recent days for doing Game of Thrones. He's one of the regular directors on Game of Thrones. So he understands the same kind of universe. But he also understands that you've got to balance that with character, and you've got to keep the plot moving forward, and that the action, you know, should supplement the drama rather than, replace it. So that it actually works very well. There is, in a way, less grandiose Asgardian stuff. I mean, plenty happens on Asgard, but it's more sort of everyday kind of matters. Whereas at the same time, you also have a lot more action, a lot more of the plot takes place in London specifically, and there are some good jokes, you know, with Thor, you know, in London. There's a good gag where he's on the tube, and he's forced to actually take the tube. There's a good gag, although London residents will tell you that actually the it's a bit of Hollywood shortcutting going on, and it's, you know, the punchline is actually not correct grammatically.
Okay.
But anyway, it's a good gag, and so overall the film works, and I think it works better than people we're expecting. It's not up to the giddy heights of the Avengers or even Iron Man 3, which has its problems, but was far bigger.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, is modest, but certainly holds its own better than I expected. So, yeah, I'm still on board.
Sounds like a definite recommendation there, James.
Yeah, I did like it. You know, and talking about it just reminds me of the things that I liked about it rather than... I think my biggest complaint with the film is that the villain, the Christopher Eccleston's space elf, is such a non-entity, which is a real shame. You know, you can't, you know, in a universe where you have created the term comic book villain, you know, which gets thrown about in all other areas of film, to have a comic book villain who is not a comic book villain, but is actually just incredibly bland and one note to the point that you can't even remember what his name is or what his plot is or anything. He has no impact whatsoever. And that's not Christopher Eccleston's fault at all. Mm. That's just the script, unfortunately. Mm. They've got too much else going on that they just needed a threat and they couldn't have it be Loki again.
Well, I'll have to sit on my hands, unfortunately, until next February. I'm definitely anticipating this one. My own feelings about the original Thor film were a little different. It's actually my favourite of the Avengers films, apart from the Avengers Assemble itself. But that's all just by the by, really, because the rest of the world will have quite possibly forgotten this film by the time we get to see it here in Japan.
Okay, now I think one thing we can both agree on is that we both enjoy watching a lot of classic movies, going back and not just focusing on the new releases all the time, really sort of exploring the depth and range of film and film history. I know that most of the Blu-rays that I tend to buy these days are for old films, you know, remastered films, but nothing delights me more than the opportunity to go back and see an old classic restored, hopefully, but it's not essential, on the big screen. And this is something that you've been doing quite a bit of recently, isn't it?
Exactly. I've had the opportunity here in Tokyo to catch some of the greatest English language films, predominantly English language films, on the big screen here as part of what's called the 10 a.m. Festival, run by one of our cinema chains in Japan, Toho Cinemas.
Now, when does that happen?
At 10 a.m. Boom, boom. The longest setup in podcast history. No, the 10 a.m. festival actually screens across the whole of Japan. Not every Toho cinema has it, but the largest multiplexes run it. And so they will.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so they will pick. There will be one film screening for. Usually it gets a 2-week run, but it varies a little bit. And it will screen every day at 10 a.m. So
every day?
Every day. So it will screen like for 2 weeks every day at 10 a.m.
Oh, that's
so fantastic. It's thrown into the mix with the regular films. And what's astonishing about these screenings, as I've been to them, is that most of them are either full or close to full. It's a really broad cross-section of people. Obviously, as you can imagine, you know, at 10 a.m. on a weekday, there's going to be quite a few retirees and older cinema goers, but there's definitely younger people there, particularly the screenings that are on a weekend. Mm. And the cinemas are, you know, as I mentioned, either full or close to full, screening in rooms that go between, say, 110 to 200 patrons.
Oh,
so not the smallest screen, obviously not the huge premiere screens, but not the smallest screens in the house either. And as is often the case when you go to the cinema here in Japan, you can hear a pin drop when everything turns black just before the film opens. So it's a really good cinematic experience.
And so the film currently playing, or the film that you saw most recently, was what?
Was the Day of the Jackal, the 1973 classic and return to form for Fred Zinnemann, adapted from a, I think it's fair to say, highly acclaimed novel by Frederick Forsyth.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And this is a film that I have a vague memory of having seen once, many, many years ago. So I don't think if you had asked me before it started what it was about that I would have been able to tell you much more than it has something to do with an assassination attempt.
Yeah, I've seen it once, probably, at a guess, I'd say 20 years ago. And I remember, you know, I remember the very, very broadest, vaguest of details.
Yeah, and I mean, it's in the making of the film is something of an interesting story. I mean, Fred Zinnemann is, I'm drawing a little blank now exactly how many Oscars he won himself. I know he won at least two Best Director awards.
He won four.
Okay.
Yeah, according to the computer in front of me,
he won.
Okay, right. As director, he won two.
Yeah.
He was also three. Sorry, and then he was a producer on A Man for All Seasons, so he won the Best Picture Oscar as well.
Best Picture Oscar, and I think probably you've got the details in front of you, but it's something like 19 Oscars went to films that he directed. So when you tally up the Oscars for the Best Actor Oscars and the other awards that his films got, he was a really highly acclaimed actor, highly acclaimed director in his day.
Yeah.
And then he had a spectacular failure. So he was slated to produce a film called Man's Fate, which was an adaptation of the André Malheur novel, The Human Condition. And that production basically failed, and he then didn't direct for a number of years, 5 or 6 years, I think. And so The Day of the Jackal was his return, and it was a commercial and critical success in 1973, and continues to this day. It's a really remarkable film to watch. I mean, seeing any of these films on the big screen, we should probably mention a few of the ones that have screened so far. Seeing any of these on the big screen is a reminder of just how good they are. A few weeks ago, I saw Enter the Dragon.
Oh, wow.
On the big screen again. You know, The Godfather, The Godfather Part Two. I was traveling, so I missed Rocky. The next one that we have coming up is The Towering Inferno, and then The Great Escape. Then we've got Raiders of the Lost Ark is our Christmas one.
Oh my God.
We'll see the new year in with 2001, A Space Odyssey. And then the last three films in the current series are Gone with the Wind, Chariots of Fire, and Psycho.
Damn. All of those are utterly unmissable.
Exactly. And we've already had Rio Bravo, Lawrence of Arabia, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Ben-Hur earlier this year. It's just fantastic to have the chance to see all of these. And the, you know, the Day of the Jackal, you see it on the big screen again. It's a really good, I think it's a 4K restoration this time around. Most of the ones I've been screening are 4K digital restorations.
Right.
So it looks really good. And it's a reminder. Some bits of the film feel a little bit dated. There are some, you know, there's quite a bit of men meeting in rooms discussing how they're going to catch this contract killer played by Edward Fox, who is the main protagonist in the film. Those pieces feel a little bit old, a little bit stagey, if you like. But then there are quite a few other scenes that are shot in and amongst normal life. The main climax of the film is actually shot during a real street parade. So it's really reminiscent of Harold Wexler's Medium Cool.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. It has that same kind of a vibe, which in 1973, that was, you know, quite cutting edge. You do get these little glimpses of what we now associate with the Paul Greengrass style of filmmaking. You know, the earliest moments of that kind of documentary style shaky cam, as it were. You also get quite a, I think for a film of that era, quite a cold, rational view of sex, very unromantic.
Well, that's one of the things I do remember about the film is that he basically picks up a girl, sleeps with her, and then kills her.
And he picks up a guy at a Turkish bath in Paris.
Oh wow!
Sleeps with him and kills him.
Oh, I don't remember that.
We're giving away too much of the film, but certainly, yeah, it is. I was kind of like, oh, really? That happens? Was that in the, you know, it's like you have this kind of, was that in the version I saw on television?
So, yeah, I don't remember that at all. But.
Yeah, so it is, it has that kind of a coolness. What I mean, sort of like emotional detachment in a way. And it is a very well acted film. Very well constructed film, and it keeps you guessing. I mean, you know, if you know any history, you know how the film ends, or you know what does or doesn't happen by the end.
Right, you know how it doesn't end.
Exactly, you know how it doesn't end, but it still manages to keep you guessing and to keep you working and intrigued and to surprise you. So it's, you know, it fits in that. I like to talk about the category of intelligent 70s cinema, and it definitely fits in that category of intelligent 70s filmmaking.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, you've got Edward Fox, but you've also got Michael Lonsdale, haven't you? Isn't he the cop on his trail?
Exactly, and I think it's probably pretty even in terms of how much time they both spend on screen. Certainly Edward Fox is the charismatic and enigmatic figure at the center of the film. But they both spend pretty similar amounts of time on screen. A nice role for a very, very young Derek Jacobi as well.
Derek Jacobi. Come on, man.
Once I've made a mistake that bad, I basically have to stick with it all the way through or else I'm going to look terrible. But he plays the assistant investigator as well. And okay. It is a film that, in a quite a delightful way, has a foot firmly in the 50s. I mean, at one point, they actually talk about activating the old boys network as a way to get the investigation going by ringing around all the major leaders of the police forces around the world. But it also feels very contemporary as well. It has that 70s breaking into a much more realist kind of political action thriller approach to cinema.
Right.
So it's a bit of both. It definitely feels a lot tougher than most of the James Bond films of that era, for example.
Yeah, of course, one of which also starred Michael Lonsdale. He was Drax in Moonraker.
Yes, mind blocks out pain. But
he's actually very good in it.
No, he is very good in a terrible film.
Yes.
But yeah, it definitely feels tougher than most of the Bond era films of that time. And you can certainly see the way it has continued to influence cinema today. I kept remembering back to George Clooney in The American. Is that what it's called? Right?
Yes, The American, yeah.
So there's a lot of parallels. That film draws a lot from The Day of the Jackal, and I was reminded of that in this one as well.
There's kind of a remake, isn't there, called The Jackal with, is it Richard Gere and Bruce Willis?
Yeah, and I think there is a bit of a story behind that as well, because certainly the people involved in the production of this one did not want it to carry the same name. So I think there is a bit of a story why it didn't actually end up being called bearing the same name, and I'm not sure how far that is an authentic remake, how much it is a complete remake of this one or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an adaptation, because Kenneth Ross wrote the script for Fred Zinnemann's version.
Yeah.
And as far as I understand, The Jackal, the 1997 Michael Keaton Jones film, is an adaptation of that screenplay.
Yeah.
Rather than going back to Forsyth's novel. I mean, it's all about an IRA, an imprisoned IRA sniper who is freed to help stop a brutal, seemingly faceless assassin from completing his next job.
Exactly.
It sounds awful. I don't think I've ever seen it.
It does go in a different direction. I mean, I think one of the fascinating things about The Day of the Jackal, which comes from Forsyth's own book and the reasons why he wrote the book, is that it is based on true life events. The actual story is fictional, but the context within which it's set and the upheaval and the rise of these kind of paramilitary groups in Western Europe, and particularly in France, you know, and a failed assassination attempt on Charles de Gaulle in response to the independence of Algeria. These were all kind of real events. And the Day of the Jackal sort of hews, it draws from that realism. I think that's one of the things historically that makes it quite an interesting film. You know, there's so much, particularly there's so much TV at the moment that's trying to recreate that era. But in a way, The Day of the Jackal is a reminder that it actually was even more dark than some of our contemporary recreations of that moment.
Excellent. So it's definitely one to revisit. It's worth, it's continued, it's held up its previous reputation as being a bit of a classic of 70s conspiracy cinema.
I think so. I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I went along almost out of the fact that I'm committed to seeing everything that's on offer on the 10 a.m. festival from now until the end of its current run.
Good.
But I was pleasantly surprised by how good and how tense and how confrontational and sexually open and ruthlessly violent the film was. And there are the odd disappointment. I mean, the way people die feels a little soft and comical compared to what we're used to today.
Mm.
And as I mentioned, some of the scenes feel a little bit stagey. But overall, it's got a fluidity and a pace and an aggression that feels winsomely contemporary. You know, I would definitely recommend it. And also,
that's not for the poster. Yeah.
Exactly, winsomely contemporary. But also, I think I've got to put a big vote in as well for seeing any opportunity you get to see one of these great films that we talk about. You know, there's films that make it into the top 100 films of all time, or, you know, the top 10 war films or action films. If you get the chance to see them on a big screen, you know, it is a different experience. And I had the opportunity as well in the last month to see The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2 on the big screen. And there's just... These films were made to be seen on the big screen. They weren't
Absolutely.
Made to be seen on a television or an iPhone or an iPad or something like that. They were made to be seen on the big screen. And, you know, seeing The Godfather... Go on.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, and as importantly, to be seen with an audience.
Yeah.
You know, you're so used to be seeing all these films like on TV or on Blu-ray, normally by yourself or just with one or two other people. But... that sounds fantastic that they're running the same film like every day for 2 weeks, and it's essentially selling out, or it's pretty full, and so you're seeing The Godfather with 100 other people.
Yes,
that for me is as much of an appeal as just seeing it in the big screen itself.
Exactly, with 100 other people who really want to be there, who aren't just there because it's an opportunity to eat popcorn or drink a big, huge, sugary drink or something like that. They genuinely want to be there. And when you see a film like The Godfather Part 2, which quite frankly is not short, okay? I mean, it's a bit like going to a day of the cricket, really. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's so tempting to pause the film if you're watching it at home, you know, or to, you know, go reheat a pizza at some point. But, you know, you're in the cinema. You don't, right? You keep going. And when it randomly cuts to the Sicilian countryside, you go with it, okay? It's all the things that are great about watching film that are, you know, being pulled out of your experience. And I walked out of the cinema yesterday seeing The Day of the Jackal, and it was every bit as good as traveling in a time machine, right? It was, for 2 hours, I was genuinely transported to a different place, to a different time, to a different world, and I felt, you know, moved. I mean, this is why we love cinema.
Yeah.
You know, this is it. So, you know, anybody thinking of doing something like this somewhere else, please do it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and if the opportunity presents itself, you know, to see one of these films as part of a film festival or a special screening or something like that, just go along. I mean, you know.
I mean, even if it's something you've seen before.
Yes.
It's an entirely different experience seeing something on the big screen. I mean, this year I've seen a few good ones myself. I've seen 2001 Space Odyssey, Citizen Kane, Chinatown, La Ventura, Heaven's Gate, Witness for the Prosecution, things like that. Most of which I've seen once, if not many times.
If not
before.
More, yes.
Yeah. Some of them I've got on Blu-ray at home, but that's irrelevant.
Yeah,
you know, this is an entirely different sort of experience, and it should not be missed.
Now, our last film for this episode is another one that I haven't had the chance to see because it doesn't open here for at least another month and a half, and that is the latest installment in the Hunger Games trilogy. It's a trilogy or a series, James?
It's a trilogy of novels. Yeah. They're doing increasingly popular trick of splitting the last book into two films, as they did with Harry Potter and as they did with Twilight.
So it's a triquality.
It's a triquality, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. depending on your medium. But yeah, this is part two. And what we do is it's essentially, I mean, just to set the scene very quickly, this is in a post-apocalyptic future where much of the Earth has been destroyed and there are 12 districts left. Each one is now run almost solely to produce one particular material or resource for all of them to enjoy, and it's all run by the capital. And obviously, as one would expect in this kind of dystopian future, the capital are reaping all the benefits while everybody else has pretty much nothing. And in order to keep everybody in line and to keep everybody entertained, they've got this kind of battle royale running man kind of scenario going called the Hunger Games, where every year by lottery one male and one female child, I think they have to be under 18, is selected at random, supposedly at random, to compete in a death match, essentially, within a sort of confined ecosystem stadium arena area. And they have a couple of days or however long it takes to kill them all. Now, at the end of the first episode, Katniss Everdeen, our heroine, played by Jennifer Lawrence, she essentially tricked the system into letting her and her male partner, a boy called Peter Mallark, played by Josh Hutcherson, who they are kind of having a relationship, or certainly an on-screen relationship, within the Hunger Games that everybody is avidly watching on TV. And they tricked the system into allowing them both to live, because they're the two survivors, and they're going to commit ritual suicide together by eating poisonous berries, and it's, you know, a red flag goes up and they're like, no, we're going to change everything because it's become incredibly popular. And the fear is that if they let them kill themselves, there'll be anarchy on the streets and the people won't accept it and they'll blame the capital for doing so. So this is how the first one ends. The second one opens and they are on their victory tour of all the 12 districts. And yes, it seems that unrest is indeed not resting. And continuing to, rebellion is bubbling under the surface and the increasingly Orwellian capital is, having to impose harsher and harsher and more increasingly violent measures to maintain order. And they think, the only way we can do this is we've got to kill her somehow. Mm-hmm. We're going to perpetuate this on-screen relationship between her and Peter, but at the same time, we've got to get rid of them. So what we'll do is this year's Hunger Games is the 75th anniversary. Instead of drawing lots from all the children in each district, we will be drawing one man and one woman from all the previous winners from each district. And wouldn't you know it, in their district, they're the only winners ever. So they're both back in again. And at this time, they're fighting older people, more experienced killers. and all the rest of it. And so it's expanded on the original premise. You see far more of what's going on outside of the Hunger Games and outside of their impoverished District 12, which is where they're from. But at the same time, it's moving in interesting ways, and it really does set up a very, very potentially exciting and interesting and will be very different Part 3. I don't know. I haven't read Part 3 yet. I don't know where it's going, but it looks like it's going to be a full-on war, essentially, and break out of the confines.
The film is a continuation of the trilogy, but if I've got this correct, you have a new director and co-screenwriter for this one?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the first one, his name escapes me. Was it Gary Ross directed the first one?
I think so, yeah.
They've got Francis Lawrence this time, who did Constantine and I Am Legend and a couple of other things. You know, they're not mind-blowing films in and of themselves, but I think it works in this instance. You know, he's a jobbing director, you might say. He's a workman-like director rather than any particular kind of auteur artiste. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's got what this kind of thing takes. This is a sci-fi action epic with broad character strokes, and it needs a visual flourish, and he brings all of those things to it. I think Gary Ross tried to do something a bit indie with his. There's a lot of handheld camera work in the first one that didn't really fit with the palette and the design of this particular vision of the future, and it was always slightly at odds. I mean, I thought the first one was a good film, but they've kind of smoothed over those issues this time out, and it's good. I mean, I think it suffers from some of the same problems that Thor: The Dark World does, where its lead characters are not quite as interesting as the supporting characters. I mean, Katniss Everdeen, Jennifer Lawrence's performance is really good. I think she stands up as a really good, positive female action heroine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think she works. I think she's a positive role. I'm actually in the middle of putting together an article for Twitch about, other women in action cinema.
Or the lack thereof.
Yeah, or just, you know, where the good ones are amongst all the dreck of things like Sucker Punch. And I think she does really well. I mean, obviously, the film and the books and the success of them, at least, owe a serious debt to the success of things like Twilight. And they do follow in the same pattern of the same model, if you like, of having a sort of love triangle at their centre. But whereas I think Twilight was a love triangle, teen angsty romance first, and they just happen to be werewolves and vampires. I think this is very much a sci-fi action thriller first, and there just happens to be a love triangle at the centre between her and her co-star, if you like, this boy Peter, and her beau back home, played by Liam Hemsworth, Thor's little brother.
Yes.
And I think the biggest problem with that dynamic is that neither of the boys are particularly interesting as characters. And I think perhaps some of that is to do with the fact that Katniss Everdeen is an incredibly strong and independent and resourceful young woman. And she doesn't need anybody. And if anything, the boys need her more than she needs them. And that instantly makes them look weak and rather sort of irrelevant and unnecessary. But especially when she is faced with, you know, an entire planet or country, at least, of corruption and, a big brother to take down and all the rest of it. You know, she hasn't got time.
That sounds potentially like a bit of a letdown in the storytelling, though, James, because if you're saying that the men look weak if the woman doesn't need them, is that a problem in the dynamic of action films, or is that a problem in the dynamic of the storytelling of this film?
You'd like to think that
because in the real world, you know, it isn't a natural consequence that strong women make men look weak.
No. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think it's not her making them look weak, but they are weak in the for the very matter that they're not fulfilling the traditional roles, if you like. You know, particularly in this kind of high-stakes, dangerous situation in which they are, with which they are reacting or interacting. There's no drama if they are both equally able. you know, you need one to be better at certain things than the other, so that one can, you know, help the other one. Otherwise, you know, there's no sense of peril, there's no sense of danger, there's no drama. And it's what's great about the film is that they make the woman the stronger character. Or the girl, the female, the stronger character. Okay. And they feel there is a necessity, therefore, to make to disable the man, therefore.
They allow it to happen.
Sure, you there might be a thesis there where you could talk about the emasculation of the men within this drama, but I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that was a in any way a reason to stop doing it. You know, I think the fact that they are creating this incredibly strong and independent woman, that she doesn't, I think the important thing to note here is that she doesn't need these men in order to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
That they are somewhat sort of superfluous. And I think that is a weakness of the storytelling, in as much as, you know, we don't feel that the romance is particularly interesting, or at least I didn't. But certainly as far as having a sci-fi action thriller in this dystopian future, which has a female protagonist at its centre, and a positive one as well, not somebody who's being fetishized in the same way as some Lara Croft or Kate Beckinsale in Underworld or anything like that. You know, she is attractive because she because of what she does rather than of how she looks.
That is enough to make it worth seeing?
I think it is worth seeing. I mean, don't attempt to see it unless you've seen the first one, because I think it is a continuation of an ongoing story.
It doesn't stand alone, then?
No, not really. I mean, these aren't another adventure. This is very much, you know, taking off where the first one left off. So this is definitely a part two. But I think the first one is well worth watching as well. And I think this kind of film should be encouraged. I think there needs to be more positive, go-getting action girls out there that don't, you know, that aren't Lara Croft, essentially.
You've got me there. I totally agree with that. Now, James, what are you going to be seeing this weekend?
I have, delightful things ahead. I think the only film I have actually scheduled to see over the weekend is the latest Vince Vaughn comedy, Delivery Man, which is a remake of, a German film called Starbuck.
Yes.
About a guy who finds out that he is...
I think it's actually a French-Canadian film.
Oh, is it? Sorry, okay. Where he's been a sperm donor in the past, and he finds out that he's got, like, he's fathered hundreds of children.
It's a very funny film, yeah.
Who are all now filing a sort of civil action against him. There's the remake of that. That's
that could be okay,
afternoon.
Yeah.
It could be okay, you know, if Vince Vaughn has suddenly decided to be the same man he was 20 years ago as opposed to the man he was last year. Mm-hmm. So fingers crossed. Next week, I will finally be seeing the new Hayao Miyazaki film, The Wind Rises, which I'm very happy about.
Mm. That should be good.
And,
I'm off.
Yeah, and I'm expecting a delivery from Criterion very soon, so that should be nice.
I'm off tonight to see Metallica Through the Never.
Oh, right, yes.
Which is a concert film that has had very mixed reviews, but I'm going in with an open mind and very little knowledge of what's actually going to happen, so I'll have some thoughts or comments for that next week.
That played at Fantastic Fest, but I didn't actually go see it.
Yeah. That might have been interesting what kind of reception it got there. Did it get a good reception?
I think Metallica fans fell over themselves for it, but I think the others were less enthused, shall we say. Okay.
Well, anyway, this has been our 42nd podcast. My Yay. Name is Fernando Groh. You can find me on Twitter at FERNANDOGROS and at my blog, fernandogroh.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at Marshy00. You can find us on Twitter at Society for Film. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSocietyForFilm. And obviously we're on iTunes and Stitcher and all those places. So please subscribe, please leave reviews, please rate us. And that will help enable us to reach more people in the future.
So until next time, I'm Fernando Groh in Tokyo.
And I'm James Marsh in Hong Kong. Goodbye. That is all fine. It's nice. Oh.
all of those things which should help